Hello, and thank you for joining me for the 10th episode in our special series of podcasts spotlighting the Arizona Institutes for Resilience and their work with individuals, businesses, and communities to manage risks associated with climate change, of which we all know there are many, and to discover opportunities associated with solving the climate crisis. I think this episode is sure to blow your green socks off, and I love that expression. Exploring the power of art to inspire action and aid in the building of resilient communities is at the heart of our conversation today. So press pause here. That's why I'm excited, because it's such a different take for us, a different content area, and I had a blast preparing. I could not be more excited to explore why and how art and artists need to be integrated into all of the conversations about building resiliency in people and in communities. I'm Gina Murphy-Darling, and this is Impact Earth, a roadmap to resilience. So can you tell everybody that I'm very excited about today's show, about our guest, about her ability to create work, which includes addressing wider issues of the natural world. And she wrote that a lot in the things that I was reading about, the natural world. And it's such a beautiful and kind of soothing way to think of our earth, which is the natural world. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Ellen McMahon, Associate Dean of Research, College of Fine Arts at the University of Arizona. Ellen, beyond wonderful to have you here. And if you'll just bear with me after you say hello, I would like to share a little bit more about you and your journey, because I think our listeners would love to learn more about you before we start.
Hi, Gina. Thank you for having me as your guest today. I'm very happy to be here. People always think I'm a doctor because I'm an associate dean. But actually, I'm a studio artist and designer, so I have a MFA, so I'm not a doctor.
Got it. Okay.
But I do have a master's in science and scientific illustration, too. So I have degrees in both sides of the fence there.
So I'm glad we did that before I started sharing everything of your bio. But it's good to know, and it really, don't I know, that it doesn't really matter, because all of the work you do matters. That's what really matters, not some title. So a snippet from your bio. In 2005, after more than a decade of creating work about domestic life, our guest expanded the focus of her visual art, design, and writing from her experience of motherhood, which is probably what got me from hello, to the wider issues of the natural world. In 2007, she received a Fulbright Scholars Grant for a six-month stay in Puerto Peñasco, Mexico, where she worked on several conservation and environmental education projects with the Center for the Study of Deserts and Oceans. So hard stop here. That is known in my world as SADO. I was actively on the board for a while. I met Ellen then. I am now a very marginally acceptable advisory board member because of my life circumstances, but I love the organization. So I'm a hanger-on. I cannot stop being a part of Center for the Study of Deserts and Oceans. So it's a small world, and I share that because we have that common ground. And I want to share just a little bit more, because it was, if I read it and I want to read more, I know our listeners are going to want to hear it. McMahon's motherhood work has been exhibited in solo exhibitions, Redressing the Mother, at AIR Gallery in New York. I don't know what AIR stands for, but it doesn't matter, because what I said is she's good enough to be in a gallery in New York. Bam, that's big. No, it's really big. I know about this stuff. Maternal Matter at Cal State San Marcos, and Ellen McMahon, Artist Books and Printed Works at the Center for Fine Print Research at the University of the West of England in Bristol, UK. So I'm like, wow, I didn't know any of that about you. She has artist books that are held in collections at UCLA, Scripps, Occidental, Texas Tech, the Center for Creative Photography, and the New York and Boston Public Libraries. And I always wonder, and I actually called Kelly about this, how much do we share about the guest? Because the bio is on the show notes. But to me, we just set the table for what you're going to share, and it really matters to me. And I meant that about being in a gallery in New York, being a gallery anywhere with juried shows and having to pass those barriers and tests is quite impressive. So let's dive in. Okay. You do have 40 years of experience making art and teaching art, as well as working on and leading interdisciplinary teams, which is what this work requires, and reading widely, and you said, I loved it, and irresponsibly in other fields. I think that's hilarious. So I thought a great place to start, and this is our show, not mine, is what is your definition of art? Do you have one?
Well, first I should say that I talk about myself as an irresponsible reader in many disciplines.
Are you glad I picked that up?
Yeah, because I'm fascinated by... I mean, I'm irresponsible in that I'm not a researcher in those other disciplines, but I'm really interested in how those disciplines help us understand what art is. So to get to also to say something about my motherhood work, I mean, it was really important for me to really delve into kind of my experience of motherhood when my children were young, when I was a faculty member, a mother, and actually running the illustration design program. And then when my children got older and they started doing their own thing, I started looking at my students and saying, here they are behind computers all the time. We need to get out into the world. And that's when I was on the board at Sato and I did that that Fulbright down there. It was all related to that. And it's like, these kids need to experience this world so that they care about doing something about it, and they need to understand that what they're learning, the skills that they're learning in as artists and designers and illustrators, they can be put to use and give them agency. Because I mean, I knew that the climate situation was just going to continue to get worse through their adulthood, and they needed to feel like they could actually do something. So working with Sato, helping with their initiatives, their eco-tours, the research, illustrating their research materials. We did a mural.
They're an incredible organization. They're an international organization, right, which is why I want to have that name attached to my bio, even though there were times when I did more than I do now, and that's the way boards are. You do what you can when you can and help them and hope to continue to do that. And we'll be sure to send them a copy of this podcast, because all the board members who are so active, many of them retired, not all, but working so hard to make the organization even more robust and healthy and impactful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll just say that to have the students, you know, knee deep in mud in the estuary, looking for those tiny little crabs that come up when you stomp and everything, and seeing the awe and delight that they experience in those places. And I had one student that was like very disengaged, and when it was at low tide, we were like walking out over this expanse of estuary, and she was sort of lagging behind. And at one point, she just said, "It's just so quiet." You know, and it's like, to think about
peace.
Yeah.
The peace. And I have said on the show and in my writings that to know nature is to love her. And the big thing is we've got to get people, and including children, to know nature. Because when you think of outside as Mother Earth's living room, you might not be as likely to throw a plastic bottle out of your car or to leave a fire unattended. There are so many things that once you feel that connection, your antenna are eternally up. That's how I feel.
Definitely.
You know, go ahead.
Well, I was going to get back to your question.
Which we don't even have to do that, but I want you to, because another thing I want to comment on, part of what I love in this journey for me is that when people like you come on the show and have these quotes and you're talking about philosophers and different artists, it enriches my life. So I wasn't just saying that. It's like, wow, that's something to stop and think about. It took me a long time to prepare this show because I read through everything. Then I looked people up and then I wanted to see what their work was, and I'm looking at the art gallery links. So tell us about what you would say art is.
Well, I'm going to quote actually one of the philosophers that I think is great, named Alva Noah. And he says that art is not a phenomenon to explain, but a form of research, an inquiry into our nature and the nature of things, The outcome is a realization of the spontaneous things that we do that are normally hidden to us. How we are self-organized by drives, reflexes, habits, and thoughts of action. And, okay, so it's very hard to define art. But
it really is.
And a much better question is, like, what does it do and how does it do it? And one way to define art is to say art is anything that does this, that shows us to ourselves in ways that are hidden to us. And so as Associate Dean for Research in the Arts, you know, one of my big questions is, you know, what is the role of art in a Research One university where research, also, you know, defined as knowledge creation, is basically defined as scientific knowledge that is provable, repeatable, you know, measurable. And so to think about, well, what kind of knowledge is created through the arts? And why is that kind of knowledge important? So so what is art? I have another really good quote.
I love it. What I love about this is I was going to ask you to share that quote from Alva Noah, and I even listened on pronunciation to see if I was saying it right, and it is. Mm-hmm. But his book, Strange Tools, Art and Human Nature, is something that in my next phase of my life, I want to get that book because
it
sounds beautiful.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and I'll just continue with one example from him, which I think is really great. He says, as humans, we are organized by habits of movement. But the art of choreography puts dancing on display to reveal that fact to us, that we are dancers by nature. And when you think about the feeling you have when you see dance or you go to live music or you go to an art gallery and you are in experiencing art, it's like that feeling you get that this is me, that I am this.
Yes.
You know,
I
am a dancer, I am a singer, this is like me as a human. And that art is a way to, you know, when that's revealed to us, we don't think of ourselves as dancers, but, you know, if you, any kind of a baby that hears music, you can see them immediately moving to the music. We are dancers.
Right, right.
I mean, that's...
Right, right.
But anyway, so this is another quote I really like by Benjamin Zander, the composer and conductor of the Boston Symphony. I think that's the... Anyway, he says... And this relates to your introduction because the first part of his art doesn't provide solutions. So when we think about climate solutions. But anyway, but a space for acknowledgement and conversation. Art transforms us by opening the emotional pores to all of life's experiences. Art shifts our molecules, bypasses our brains, awakens experience, brings people together, changes our sense of being and brings emotional satisfaction. So it's like, yes, it's how change, I mean, it's where change happens. there are no solutions without the individual change needed to build consensus, make policy, you know, change.
It's everything.
It's everything.
And when you think about it, even... There's more. Like, this is going to be, we're going to talk about this as the show full of really great, impactful quotes. But I wanted to, you wrote, as the first associate dean for research, the first, in the arts at the University of Arizona, one of my responsibilities is to help people understand art as a form of research, which you have very elegantly done in what you gave to me. This is the necessary first step to the goal of a meaningful integration of the arts into the science-dominated research ecosystem of the university. And it's like, bam, I want to slam the table, the desk down, because we have to do that. Like, it's so critical. And that's what my friend Jim Beiser said. He wants to make science real to people outside of the walls and the boundaries of the U of A and outside of the scientific community. And what more like so benign, so non-threatening, so potentially impactful is art. It's real. I mean, pictures, sometimes nothing impacts a person more than a picture, which if you're a photographer is your art. And I know we don't have the experience of an entire semester with you, but can you just expand a little bit on why it's a form of research? Because that's going to lead to the next question about how can you, in any life form, connect it to climate resiliency? And you can. Mm-hmm. So just expand a little bit about how art is research.
So this is part of my, irresponsible research.
I love that. I am so going to use that.
So I read a lot about neurolinguistics, and okay. I'm very fond of George Lakoff, who is at Berkeley, and he talks about this is pretty much an agreement among neuroscientists that 90% or more of our thinking is not available to our conscious awareness.
Blew me away. 90%.
Yeah. So anytime we talk about knowledge or research or anything, we're using less than 10% of our thinking. Okay, so...
And I knew that, and it still blew me away to read it again.
Yeah, So one of the metaphors I love about the mind, how the mind works, is 2,500 years old, and it's a metaphor of a very small person riding a very large elephant. And the very small person is our conscious awareness, and the elephant is everything else, all the other ways that our bodies are thinking, And actually, all the new research talks about how our thoughts come from our bodies, you can't separate them. But anyway, so, the rider wants to go left, the elephant wants to go right, and of course, you're going to go right because that's where the elephant wants to go. And so then the rider gets all of these sort of nuanced ways of convincing the elephant that it's a good idea to go left.
But got it.
It's the elephant's got to agree. And so that's all of your unconscious thinking, and that is the realm of the arts. And so when you talk about how is art research, first of all, research is knowledge creation. That is the definition. So knowledge creation in the sciences depends on certain rules of repeatability, measurability. But knowledge creation in the arts, I like to think of three kinds of knowledge: embodied knowledge, poetic knowledge, and personal knowledge.
Okay.
And personal knowledge being not just who am I, but what's my place within all of the interconnections that I exist in. And that is really central to all kinds of indigenous knowledge, because indigenous people are completely interactive with all of the life forms around them. So those three kinds of knowledge, if you think about those as knowledge that's created through art, that's how I think of it as research.
So I get it. I mean, I really get it. And then the other part, and here's another, I'm paraphrasing Nancy Mayers, mm-hmm. In a voice lessons. Here it is. I love this. When you get the particulars just right of your own experience, this is it. This is the big bam. You invite others over the threshold into their own experience. And you said poetic objectivity, expressing something you don't understand with precision. And when I think about art in a very, very broad sense, like to me, a really well-written book is a piece of art. I mean, very broad interpretation. So when I read that, it's like people make fun of me because like Gina's on to her next thing, where I want everybody to read it, or rent the movie, or watch the book, or mm-hmm. go to the gallery, or mm-hmm. look at this artist, so that when you talk about what's happened to me on this journey almost every day, when you recognize the reality of climate change and want to get people into the mindset of climate resilience, they have to first acknowledge that there is even climate change. And I was thinking about, Is there a more benign, more gentle, more appropriate way to help us find common ground than through the arts, which is books? I mean, I've done it successfully with some books, sending it to people like that were mm-hmm. wolf killers, mm-hmm. a bit of an exaggeration, but not really, and sending them this book, Wolf Nation, by Brenda Peterson. And this is a very, he's become a dear friend. It changed his whole trajectory of how he hunts. And he told other hunters I would have zero credibility with most hunters. He thought I was against hunting. And I said, that's the stereotypes that are just so devastating, because if we don't have hunters, we're in a lot of trouble.
Yeah.
But to your point about this content that you gave me, getting really excited about something and passionate and being authentic, it's contagious. That's mm-hmm. the word I use. It's contagious. And they're like, oh my gosh, what is she talking about? And it does help. It, mm-hmm. it just really helps to expand the mind. And I love that. Can you expand a little bit on why it matters when it does come to climate resilience? Because you are a part of Arizona Institutes for Resilience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it matters so much. But I want you to tell us why it matters so much.
Yeah.
That connection.
Well, I mean, scientists are very open to working with artists because they are frustrated with
getting out the message,
exactly, and how little response there is to the message and how slow that response is. And so, and also they feel also that they have to remain somewhat neutral in order to be taken seriously within that realm. And they are not feeling that way at all. So they really appreciate artists to come in and, you know, sort of like be more expressive about the issues. The other thing is the personal, like the Nancy Mayer's quote, you know, that is a book on writing. And I use it all the time with my art students, because that idea of getting that precise, personal, like I always say, art is personal but not private. And it's personal and public, right? It's personal and it reaches another person, and then in that way it's public, but it's not private. And this idea of sharing that specific and mysterious experience that you have internally with other people, that is what moves them. So art differs. So climate communication, okay, that's what we're talking about really. It's like, how do we communicate what science knows about the climate? And you could say that art differs from other forms of communication in a few important ways. Okay, so it's novel, right? So it demands attention in certain ways. And it can create controversy and conversation through that. It requires processing and reflection to understand it. So one thing that art does is it makes you confused. Okay, so it can make you confused and surprised and disoriented. And that is where that is required for change. Because one of our big problems is we're all too overconfident. We think we're right. And we have to, in order to change as a culture, as a species, you know, we have to question our beliefs. So art can put you back on your heels and sort of like, oh, what is this? What am I looking at? What's going on? And then you have to do that processing. And, you know, then you have that experience also that comes from the very personal. And then it can visualize problems and possible solutions too. So it can look into kind of future ways of imagining things. And a really big important thing that art does is it gathers people together based on values. And what George Lakoff says is, you know, information doesn't move people if it's not wedded to values.
And the translation for that is facts don't get in the way.
Yeah.
And when I read that, I went, it's so true. You can present data points till someone falls asleep, but that information is not usable by the recipient if they mm-hmm. don't want it to be.
Yeah.
Is that accurate?
Yeah. No, there's a really great book called How Climate Change Comes to Matter The Communal Life of Facts. I love this book.
Oh my God.
It's by Candace Callison, and she's an anthropologist. And basically, she takes five groups, including the corporate world, the creationists.
Right, the creatives.
Yeah. Are the Christian, right, and the Inuit, and two other groups, I can't remember. And she says, okay, what are the values of this group? And how can climate change be communicated in these groups? Well, in the corporate world, it's communicated as risk, economic risk.
Impacting the bottom line.
Exactly.
Money.
And in the Christian communities, it's messaged as protecting creation.
Which it does say in the Bible. I've had some guests that are very Christian on our show, and they say in the Bible it says that God said we are to be good stewards of our earth.
Yeah.
That is our responsibility. So.
Yeah. And the Inuits, you know, they the term ground truthing basically refers to it being their entire life way, livelihood. Art does speak through values, and that can be a really important part of the communication, understanding audiences too.
So to your point, and I mean, this is cracking me up because I'm loving that this interview is going exactly where we want it, and that's it. Like, throw out the notes, here it comes. Because you can tell already, I'm sure, that this was very personal to me preparing for this. It wasn't about a lot of other topics I cover. It's like I'm consumed with sometimes my lack of stepping into that realm, and how in my golden years I want to do more of that. I was a Shakespearean. I could have been a Shakespearean scholar. I got A's in Shakespeare. That's a different language. It's another art form. But I want to talk to you about, just share with you about Hamilton, which is probably one of the biggest cultural phenomena of our time. I think it is, arguably. So I got invited to go to see Hamilton with my daughter. And I think it's kind of funny, I do, Ellen, that people say, did you understand the words? That's almost what everybody says. And I didn't understand all the words. I have never understood all the words. Some people got the audio. You could get a script to read. So what I decided to do when I went was totally relax, take a deep breath, not try to catch every word, and to simply enjoy the art of that performance. The dancing was mesmerizing, the body movements, the set design, the costumes. It was such a positive experience for me. And I did understand more of what was going on, because it's first of all, the acoustics where I went are not good. We don't have to name that if I didn't already, but they're working on it. Mm-hmm. So the acoustics were an issue. We had a really wonderful seat. But when you're experiencing art, whether it's standing in front of a painting in an art gallery that you're like, when I have done that, it's like, what is this all about? Mm-hmm. It's not like looking like Picasso, the early years, where you really knew what he was thinking because it was so illustrative of what it looked like. It was like a photograph. But I think it's expanding people's minds who listen to this interview about a very broad interpretation of art and why it so matters, because nature is the ultimate, it's ultimate art. Everything in art is taken from nature. So that connection, I really got it. And I don't know if you want to comment on that, because you know me, I have all the questions ready, and I don't know if there's anything you want to add to that. But it's kind of like you made a very good point at bringing the beauty and the essence and the importance of it out. And that's what I want to pull out for the audience. And sometimes when I share my own experience, they have an aha moment. So,
well, I just want to say that sometimes art is very moving, but not in a pleasurable way.
Also true. First thing that comes to mind, this just in, the Holocaust Museum.
Oh,
I'll never
forget
it as long as I live. And one would have to argue that that is art.
Yeah. Yeah, and there was a piece called Pollution Pods, which was created to kind of really specifically see how people could be changed in their ideas about climate through art. And there were a bunch of these little geodesic domes that had air that was simulated from different polluted cities across the world. And it was in Norway in this really pristine, beautiful place. And they moved it. It moved to several cities in the world. But so people could walk through these different domes, you know, and they would be different cities.
And experiencing
the way the air looked and smelled. Of course, they had to simulate it because it couldn't be the real pollution because that would
might
be dangerous.
Yeah. I know.
So there's an organization called Climb Art, and they did a lot of research about how contemporary art can communicate about climate change, well, change people's feelings about climate change. And one of the projects they did is called Pollution Pods. And it was, I think it was five domes that were connected by little walkways that were first installed on this beautiful fjord area in Norway. But each pod had polluted air from cities around the world. So the visitors, you know, would walk through one pod and it would be Beijing, you know, and another pod would
be... I was going to say Beijing had to be number one.
New York City and... And that they actually did a lot of science to figure out how to simulate the smell and the look of the air without actually
without
poisoning
our
people.
Lungs. Yeah, that's good. I was like, I would not go in the Beijing pot.
But they actually did a survey, like before and after, about you know people's views about and whether they might take action and related to climate change.
Right, so, right.
Yeah,
I bet that was impactful. I mean, it is, mm-hmm. and again, it's another form, a powerful form of art, which is illustrative of what this show is about. Mm-hmm. It's just about that was an artistic way, and it should be in on tour in New York City and Washington, D.C. and San Francisco and Denver. It should go around.
Yeah, so that's a good experience of example of an experience of art that was not pleasant but was impactful.
Yes, yes, not pleasant. And then, and like I said, it was very hard for me to go through the Holocaust Museum. There have been other experiences like that where you just make yourself do it because those people earned the right for us to be aware.
Oh, yes. I've heard people talk about the shoes, the pile of shoes.
Oh, that was one of the worst things ever. Yeah. Like, oh my gosh, man's inhumanity to man. So I wonder sometimes if I were going to be doing podcasts for the next 10 years, if every guest got a question similar to the impact of the pandemic on all known things. And as you know, Jim Beiser is a really good buddy. We talk about it, how mm-hmm. we doubt it's he informs me. Speaking of, he's like my ultimate artist. He paints mm-hmm. all these canvases that I'm trying to figure out. What are you even talking about? Mm-hmm. But how has the pandemic or has it informed your work or maybe even provided clarity about people's behavior? I mean, we went back to, you said, information, data points, numbers don't convince some people, obviously. It blows my mind. Because in the science world, if you can't measure it, it didn't happen.
Yeah.
So how has the pandemic impacted that or informed you in your work as a leader in the college where you are and having to, we have to keep talking about COVID because it's real and it's still with us and it's a part of our culture now. Mm-hmm. So is there any response you have to that? I never want to put a guest on the spot, but it's...
Well, I'm fascinated by the stories in the Times recently, the graphs they're showing of people's perception of risk based on their age and their political leanings.
I've been watching. Yeah. I've been watching too.
So very liberal people under 35 are the most worried about the risk of COVID. So basically, we all see the same science. We all get the same information. But our perception of our personal risk is totally different depending on our political position. You know.
How sad in this particular case because COVID doesn't care how we voted in the last election.
And the whole thing about following the science, it's like, neither side follows the science. It's not about the science. It's about belief systems. It's about the that whole part of the of our cognition that's not really rational. That's not about our conscious decisions. I was up at the Biosphere for the week doing a creative climate training, which Diana Liverman brought here. with a UK organization called Julie's Bicycle as the world was shutting down because of COVID. And I drove home every night and listened to the radio as the book festival closed down, South by Southwest closed down, this basketball season, you know, canceled. And I was thinking about how I was kind of watching things fall away. And I was thinking about what it means to be a human, like how we, it's so funny because I was actually interviewed on a, as part of a podcast that one of those people was were doing. But anyway, it was people from all over the world for a week at the Biosphere talking about how the creative world can respond to climate change. And these people were, they were actors, musicians, all kinds of people. But, and a lot of them just went into 2 years of very, very difficult times.
Right, dark times.
Dark times. Being canceled, pulled out from under them, their whole livelihood basically being destroyed by this. But I think that it's important for us, I guess on a more abstract or sort of higher view of it, that it's hubris. You know, like we think that we are bulletproof when it comes to the rest of the natural world, which of course we're part of, that we can treat that world in any way that we want for our own purposes, and that we're not going to be hit by it. Like, we don't think that a tiny virus is going to shut our world down, but it will, and it did, and it still has, you know, it still is. And I think that that's the lesson in this, is to try to, I don't know, just be more humble about what we do and do not have control over.
Point. Arrogance is part of this. And it's, you know, I've argued with people and say, you see that sign, no shirt, no shoes, no service? You don't try to go in there without a shirt. Mm-hmm. What's the big deal? Because that's the same enforcement that is about wearing a mask. It when you're me, it's befuddling at times, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm like, I don't understand. And that's not helpful in moving conversations forward. So I'm working on that. I'll probably be working on that for a really long time. But another thing that I want to just kind of go into the domain of, in Mrs. Green's world, I would say one of our core values of every one of our small but mighty team members is, to varying degrees, about living consciously or being mindful. Because I believe, and a lot of my team does, that if you are mindful, every decision you make is impacted by that mindfulness, especially as it relates to the environment. And I mean as simple as which way I'm going to drive so that I'm more efficient in the way I drive, about what I buy based on the packaging or the sourcing of it. So many things. Like, you know, I think it's hilarious that I order now exclusively from Who Gives a Crap for toilet paper, because I read several articles and I'm like, I can't keep buying this toilet paper at Costco. So I've never bought it again. And it's, is it a little bit more money? Yes, I can take it out of somewhere else because I don't drink lattes. And I say, well, I don't drink lattes. I can do Who Gives a Crap toilet paper. So this is a hard question, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Do you think most people are living consciously or mindfully? When you go back to what you said about using 10% of our brain, are we living consciously? Like, what the heck? Where is that switch that we can pull? Because if everybody was, they'd be looking up pictures of Lake Mead every day and seeing how it measured today, whether you're in the Southwest or not, because our water shortage is the world's water shortage. So what do you, I see you as a philosopher, as a Renaissance woman, as someone that knows a lot about a whole heck of a lot. Are we living consciously as a population?
Well, there's a lot of ways to approach that. I think one thing to say is that mindfulness is really on the rise in this country.
I love that answer. I agree.
I mean, it's massive because people just more and more realize that what we're doing is not working. The way we're doing it is not working.
Correct. Correct.
So I think a lot of people are finding some focus and some sort of refreshed way of looking at things through actually practice, mindful practices. But there was something else I wanted to say about that, and that is that we are creatures of habit, right? And that's where art comes in, and even like an amazing, I mean, I think writing is an incredibly important art form.
I agree.
But the way things are written, that's, you know, the art of it. We're creatures of habit. And that's really where art comes in. And that's where, because we need to be shaken from our habits. And if we're just, I mean, that has to do too with what we take for granted. I heard a story that really stuck with me that someone came from another country and they were talking about just homes in the United States. They came from a country where there is very little running water. And I can't remember where this comment came from, but this idea that we fill our toilet bowls with potable water.
That we could drink.
Drinking water.
Oh my God, it kills me.
And
yes, it does.
It was some kind of a joke about how they have these amazing porcelain fountains, you know, because we could be drinking that water, but this is what we're used to, and it's just really hard to change that.
And if you don't go to another country, like in Puerto Peñasco, where it says when it's yellow, let it mellow; when it's brown, flush it down. That's very personal to talk about on the air. I could care less. Mm-hmm. Everybody who's listening should think about it because you don't have to flush every time. And that inspired me, that information, to get high efficiency toilets, not low flow, because my husband said we're not getting any low flow toilets. Well, they've improved so much. They're very efficient and they use less than a third of the water that our other toilets were using for a very low investment because of the incentives that the City of Tucson Water Department gave for new toilets, for high efficiency toilets.
I mean, I know I read a number of years ago that we actually use less water in Tucson.
We do.
Than we ever before.
That's an awareness.
Because low flow toilets or efficient toilets are required in all new building.
So it's really important, yes, but I'm thinking when you said is water we could be drinking, and you probably know this, what's in our future, we're going to be drinking that water after it's flushed down.
Yeah.
And it's going to get fixed.
The city of El Paso is all on recycled water now.
It's hard for me to fathom, but I know I'm going to do it. It's a mental thing. Mm-hmm. It's a mental block, 100%. It'll probably be purer than the water that we drink out of the faucet.
Well, speaking of design, of art, design, and advertising, of course, a design is completely essential to advertising, is think about the millions, if not billions of dollars that were invested in convincing people to buy bottled water, single serving bottled water
in
plastic.
In our lifetime. We never had bottled water when I was a kid growing up. We had a thermos.
Yep.
Remember thermos? T-H-E-R-M-O-S, people, thermos. That's what we used to put our water in when I went to school every day.
So the massive investment was made into people not trusting city water and buying bottled water as a lifestyle, healthy lifestyle choice, because it's healthier than a soda that you might be buying at that same time. But think that same investment is going to need to go into people being comfortable with recycled water. It needs to be smart, good advertising, basically, to change
people's
minds.
So the artists will be, I'm sure they're already busy at work, because I've had some guests on about how do you couch. There's an experiment that the people at the county are doing with making beer out of it. So I thought, well, I don't drink beer, so good. I'm good. I don't have to worry about that. But that is, to me, so going to be real in my lifetime, because when you look, especially in the desert Southwest, and what's happening with the Colorado River, and for the first time in my life in 50 years living in this part of the country, we went to Taos, New Mexico, and there was no water in the Rio Grande. None.
Wow.
In one of the places, none. And I was like, I freaked. When you talk about living mindfully, I wish that I had not seen that. It was like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry I saw that. So I agree with you about the mindfulness. I see more advertisements, classes, people talking about it, reading about it. So I think that's a really good trajectory for us to continue to go to. And I love what you said about under 35-year-olds because it's their future.
Yeah.
And I keep saying, I heard a story today that I want to share because I think it really matters when you talk about behaviors and our behaviors. I had breakfast with a man named Jim Reese, who was on our show 10, 12 years ago. Maybe 14. His two children were on the show at ages 8 and 9. They are now freshmen at Loyola and Georgia State, doing incredible things. They're flown all over the world to give presentations. I am so not kidding. Olivia and Carter Reese, they started a nonprofit called One More Generation. And Jim was telling me this morning about Carter. I love these kids, but he was telling me about Carter went into the Amazon, into Ecuador, which is where my journey started. So I was talking about travel, and I said, Jim, I'm really feeling called to go back there. I want to reconnect with the Achuar people. So I'm really putting it out there again. So he told me about Carter's experience, and he said they went on this research project, and they not only discovered 4 new species. You know, they had tribesmen helping carry everything, which I did. I did talk about privilege. When I went in, I could barely walk up some of those paths, and my boots got stuck in the mud and all that. But there was one of the men from one of the tribes. They didn't speak to the guests. They did the whole Machu Picchu trek, 5 days. And so the last night, Carter is by himself with this man, well, alone with this man, who they didn't speak, any of them, for this 5-day trip. They spoke to each other, but not to the guests or whatever. And so this man says, in English, perfect English to Carter, he goes, so I understand that you really care about the environment. So Carter's first thing is, oh my gosh, he speaks, and we haven't been speaking to him. Mm-hmm. And they spent most of the night up talking about the environment and the preciousness of the Amazon and all that stuff. And this man said to him, you know about getting a high temperature, right? You burn up and you get really sick and it can kill you. He said, well, people are the fever that the earth has and they're heating it up so much. And there again, it's a great visual for people to be conscious. And I thought, you know what? He's right. It's people that are the problem. It's not anything to do with the planet whatsoever. That's a conversation shift that I think has to happen. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about some of my favorite people.
Okay.
Because I have a big smile on my face. It's so sincere. The blessings in my life in this journey that I have friends for life now. And we're going to do a quote from my friend Kathy Jacobs because she has lots of quotable quotes. She is, to me, I tell she's one of the world-renowned experts on water in the Southwest, and I don't think that's an exaggeration at all. Mm-hmm. She knows it all. She knows a lot about other places too, but she's an amazing human being. This is, I love it. It's another bam, Ellen. We don't need more science. We need people to change their behaviors. Mm-hmm. That's the thing. There's the rub. You and I know scientists are extremely frustrated because of what they know about the climate crisis and that it hasn't shifted public opinion enough. It hasn't formed public policy or informed public policy nearly enough. But this is the good part where we get to share. You get to share about some of the people that you're working with and what they are doing who are very enthusiastic about getting help with this from artists. So let's start with Diana. She's always up to something.
Oh, yeah. I just want
Diana Liverman. I should say her last name. And I love these people. Diana Liverman. Oh, my God. She wants to talk about Greg Garfin and Kathy. Mm-hmm. So go ahead.
Well, actually, I just want to say Kathy wrote that as part of the foreword of the book that I edited called The Art, Design, and Science of a Dry River. And she wrote the foreword to the book. And it was so great to have a scientist basically, you know, sort of bless the art projects.
And, yes, yes.
And Greg Garfin wrote a really great essay in it about the about water in the Southwest. And Diana Liverman started the Art and Environment Network probably about 10 years ago, and I was also one of the founding members of that. And Greg Garfin was in that group. And I've known Kathy since she did the flowers for my wedding.
I'm jealous. Like, I don't want anybody to know
she's
Kathy longer
genius.
Than I am.
She's a genius.
And her daughter's wedding in Maine.
Oh, have you seen her flowers?
Oh, my gosh. Yes. So she's there. Really she's good. An artist. Yeah. She's an artist to the core of her being.
Yes, she is.
So I better get my flowers looking better for when she's coming over.
Yeah. I have worked with them for quite a while in trying to bring artists and scientists together for various kinds of projects. And Greg Garfin introduced me to David Brashears.
Who I don't know, and it bothers me.
Yeah.
How do I not know him?
He's great. You should have him on the show.
I thought about that immediately because my son-in-law is a frontline firefighter.
Yes, and Dave is a Aldo Leopold scholar, which means that he's a scientist that's very interested in science communication.
Yeah.
But anyway, so Greg introduced us because I wanted to do something about forests, and the Tree Ring Laboratory was also looking for artwork because this is kind of a long story I probably shouldn't go into, but we built a lot of beautiful buildings on the U of A campus, and there was supposed to be a percentage for art in all of those buildings, and it would have been a significant amount of money, but the legislature stopped honoring that percentage for art. So lots
shocking. Arizona?
I know.
No.
Lots of great buildings with beautiful big walls showing world-class architecture for world-class science.
I can't even.
And art is left out. So I thought it would be a great sabbatical project to fill the Tree Ring building with artwork about forests and about the research going on here. So anyway, I went out in the field with Dave Brashears and his people and made photographs and various kinds of other art forms. And then back at the field station, he showed me these beautiful images that is their data. And they're hemispherical photographs of the canopy of the forests.
Oh.
As the forests are, well, they take a transect of different forests, and they're basically looking at the canopy, which is helping them measure the heat that hits the ground, which relates to the, it increases the risk for all the other trees around the dead tree. Anyway, so I made a piece for the lobby of the Tree Ring Building, and now it's at the Center for Creative Photography right now as part of the show that they did as a collaboration between their permanent collection of photographs and the Tree Ring Building. But anyway, it's called Change Over Time. And I took their hemispherical photographs and I made consecutive rings, like tree rings, of their little circular images.
Got it.
And I arranged them so that it reads both as rings and rays, so it's kind of optically active when you look at it. And it's 10 feet by 10 feet, so
I've got to see it.
You've got to see it in person.
I've really got to see it.
Yeah, you have to see it in person.
That's more about my life. And, you know, I'm being mindful of the time. We have arguably less than 5 minutes left, but it's my show, so
okay.
That can go either way. But I do want to ask you two more questions, and I have to ask it of people like you. Do you have hope for our future? Do you think that there's, what gave me hope in what you said is that more people are living mindfully, but it's going to have to take a seismic shift in behaviors for us to, and hope, you know what I mean by hope.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to burn up or not? Basically, that's what it is. Are we going to have water or not? Or is everybody going to starve or not? But do you see a way forward for a, I don't even know what the word is anymore, Ellen, for a more consciously lived population so that they understand everything has a consequence or an impact?
Mm-hmm.
Everything. Brushing your teeth, washing your hair, doing the laundry, everything, where you eat, what you eat. So do you have hope?
I have hope at the scale of each individual interaction.
Okay.
And
what a great answer.
And that's really important to me because
that's a great answer.
The quality of everybody's moment is within our control if we're interacting with them. Well, right now we have a war going on, you know, that we don't even know how that's going to escalate. So if you go out too far, it's so far beyond your control, you know.
It is. And,
I think
it can shut you down.
So that's part of the mindful thing is like, what can I do in this moment, you know, which gives me a sense of meaning. Like when you say about choices, about what you buy and everything like that. That's how we create meaning for our own lives. And the more that that spreads, the better.
Okay. That's a really and truly great answer. And it gives me a framework from which to go. Because some days, I mean, some days I think this is a really tough job, interviewing mm-hmm. people that know what the measuring and the metrics and the data are indicating. And when I see pictures of Lake Powell and Lake Mead in our part of the country, this is a national broadcast, mm-hmm. but other people can say, yeah, well, my roof caved in because I had so much snow, or my yeah. driveway's no longer there because the flood washed it away. I mean, those are things that I think are helping with bringing more people over to the side of knowledge and science and the ability to change. So in the last 2 minutes, is there anything that you're sitting there saying, oh my gosh, Gina, you didn't ask me this, it's really important, I wanted to throw that in. I'm thrilled that we got some of the people that we love and admire and respect in, because they're all those people are doing great work. And I can attest to all of them, except for the forest man, Brashears.
Yes, and you've got to get him on.
I do.
Yeah, I can say that I came to the university 40 years ago, 42 years ago, to get a master's in scientific illustration, and I've been teaching in the School of Art for most of that time, but it's been such a great pleasure. At some point, I don't know, about 20 years ago, I thought, I want to reach across campus and have my life more diverse, you know, in the kinds of people that I interact with. And it has been a really, really great for me to be in such a interdisciplinary environment as a university. And I must say, I've been able to make the career that I wanted to make here, and I'm very grateful for that.
It's wonderful to say that. And it's a great atmosphere in many ways over there now. I mean, there's a lot of enriching things and changes, and I love AIR. I love the Howery program. I love a lot of those things that are connected to a lot of the people we talked about.
Oh, I want to make one pitch.
Okay.
I'm a mentor in a really great new program, which is called the Diana Liverman Scholars Program.
Oh, I'm so glad you did that. It was in
my
notes.
Yeah.
And we're running out of time. Thank you.
Yes.
She'll thank us.
And it's for undergrads, and it's all about experiencing the amazing place that we live in and working with nonprofit organizations that are doing great things, and getting undergraduates to help them with their environmental communications. And I've been so grateful to be able to bring art into the conversation and the power of art. And I gave them a lecture to them a couple months ago called Art, a Strange Tool for Environmental Communication.
I love it. And I'm so glad we remembered that, because it is bringing the next generation forward. And I was very excited when I read about that. So nice save for me not to go, oh, we forgot to bring that up. And, you know, Diana Liverman is all about the students, as you know. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's her life. She lives her life. She has sacrificed a lot to have students be her life, mm-hmm. her children, so to speak.
Yeah.
Okay, so my last words are somewhat emotional. Shocking, I know, because I'm such a dry, unemotional person. But I have to say that it was delightful and fun and uplifting preparing for and actually being a part of this show. How wonderful it was for me to read about philosophers and you're sharing their wisdom. I loved that the content of this show was anything but fluff. It wasn't fluff. It wasn't about drawing pictures. It's about the real meaning of art. I want to say that Ellen McMahon knows her stuff. She gets it. She does live consciously and is clearly dedicated to helping more people do the same. Besides all of the science behind what Ellen has shared with us about the intersection of art and its impact on climate change, there is a meaningful, impactful, almost joyful aspect to what she shared, because I experienced it. I need that. So once again, I find myself standing in awe, forgetting to learn from and spend time with a person who has lived an incredible life already and who continuously and consistently works to share, to make our one planet inhabitable, one that will survive. Every day, to me, the clock ticks louder. The rivers in our country, in our part of the country, continually to literally disappear. Our CO2 emissions continue to increase, and the climate cancer continues to spread. So thank you, Ellen McMahon, for being a part of a bright spot, an important spot in what some days appear to me to be filled with only darkness and bad news. This is where I am getting choked up, because that's real. I know that I can never give up. It's not in my nature, and I will never stop doing work that matters. And it's people like Ellen McMahon who provide me with the impetus I need to keep on going. So, Ellen, thank you for that, for giving your time today, and for continuing to do what you do on our behalf. It's been an honor and a pleasure. And my final thanks, as always, to you, our listeners. And you know the line, because without you, there would be no us. I'm glad we have an us. And Ellen, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Gina. It's been really great.
I did tear up, people, and I think the world needs more tears. I'm not apologizing for them. So thank you.